I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, Doug Tallamy, University of Delaware entomologist, makes his case for something he calls a homegrown national park. He's asking home gardeners living in cities, suburbs, and in rural parts of the country to plant native plants, shrubs, and trees to help birds and bees and other pollinators who face an uncertain future. His new book is titled Nature's Best Hope. But first, has concern about the pandemic, which has dominated the news, resulted in decreased concern about climate change? A national survey, Climate Change in the American Mind, conducted in early April, found that no, worry about climate change has not fallen off. We asked Anthony Leiserwitz to explain the results. He's director of the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. He's also the lead author of this study. And Anthony Leiserwitz, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. Why did you want to do this study in the middle of the pandemic?
So we've been conducting this study for over a decade. So we do national studies of the American public every spring and every fall. So this was just our next version of that. And in particular, we were very interested to see how American opinion about climate change would respond given two major crises that we're facing right now. One, obviously, the COVID pandemic with now just about 100,000 U.S. deaths, and in parallel, of course, a massive economic crisis of unemployment already at about 20%, which is twice the amount of unemployment that we saw back in the Great Recession of 2009. So in this time where such obvious huge pressures are facing the country as a whole, as well as, of course, many people individually directly, what would then happen to climate change? Because there's long been an assumption that people have what's called a finite pool of worry, that they can only worry about so many things at a given time. And so it's part of the concern for those of us who work on another massive crisis, which is climate change. There was concern that perhaps Americans would just be like, oh, forget about it. We can't even think about it. We're so fixated on these other two, we can't process it. Turns out that's not the case at all. American views of climate change haven't budged, and in fact, in many cases, have reached all-time highs in terms of beliefs that it's happening in human caused.
And I do want to get into some of the details, but I was also thinking, and this is completely unscientific, I just think everybody's worried about everything at this point.
Yes and no. I mean, we're actually going to have far greater insight into that in the next week because we're about to do a subsequent report on how this has changed people's voting priorities for the fall 2020 election. And we do know that certain issues, when they're not talked about, when they get supplanted, especially in the news by other issues, they will drop in public priority. So I don't think it's just a generalized, we worry about everything. And this is actually, the climate change results are very consistent with an upward surge in public concern that we've seen over the past 5 years.
Would you say then we are turning a corner when it comes to climate change skepticism?
I would say that corner was turned probably about 5 years ago. We see far less attention paid to those that claim it's a hoax or that it's just not even an issue at all. That's ship is largely sailed. I mean, you'll find a few pockets of people who still hold to conspiracy theories. Now the question's really turning more to what do we do about it? And so I'd say the conversation is finally starting to get to the question of action.
Well, and I do want to talk about that as well. Let me just read a couple of the findings from the report. 73% of Americans think global warming is happening. A record-tying 62% of Americans understand that global warming is mostly human-caused. Is that in part because we're kind of seeing right in front of our eyes the impact of climate change with these extreme weather events?
So this is where people are complicated, and there's multiple things happening. So one is the science has gotten ever stronger in the past few years, and there have been a number of major international and national reports lately that have helped people understand that this is real, it is human-caused, and it's not just distant in time and space, that the impacts are actually here and now. They are being experienced and harming Americans from every walk of life in every part of the country right now. That awareness is beginning to fully emerge among the public. Second is what you're talking about, is direct experience. Again, right. That people aren't just hearing about it in the news, they're increasingly beginning to see these ever more extreme storms or droughts or the massive fires that we had out in the West recently, et cetera. And then, more importantly than anything else, is that as a society, we've been talking about it. And in particular, our political leaders have been talking about it. Up until, you know, just the past couple of months, until the COVID crisis, for example, you saw every single person running for the Democratic nomination for president, every single one of those people were talking about climate change as a crucial problem that they were going to try to address right from the very beginning. That's unheard of in American political history for all candidates for one of our major offices to be constantly talking about climate change. So, again, there are lots of things going on here, but in the end, it kind of creates this snowball effect, if you will, of people talking about engaging with and growing in concern about climate change.
I wonder, too, and this is short-lived because the pandemic is just a couple of months old, but we are seeing scientists, you know, speaking to the American public, being interviewed on radio and television, and whether just having scientists have a more prominent role in speaking to this crisis helps us give scientists like yourself and others who have been concerned about climate change a kind of platform.
Yeah, Marty, that's such a great observation. So I think below the issue of climate change and even the pandemic is a deeper discussion, a deeper narrative that the United States is starting to reacquaint itself with. And that is that science matters, that facts matter, that you need to trust experts because your life may depend on listening to them. That's just a good reminder. I mean, we live in this incredibly technological, scientifically driven age, right? I mean, everything about our lives has come out of, has been so influenced by the findings of science and technology. And yet in recent years, we've seen increasing questioning of expertise, of scientists, of questioning their motives in the space of climate change. People are suggesting that scientists just make these facts up because somehow they're getting rich off of climate change.
Hard to believe.
Okay. Anyway,
right.
Hard to believe. So anyway, that assault on the very notion of empirical data, of facts themselves, that we can, in fact, derive clearer understandings of the way the world works. COVID has really just brought that right front and center to all of us. And suddenly we each have to make core decisions about the risks that we take. Do we go out into the public? Do we wear a mask? Do we wash our hands? Do we do all these things to try to protect ourselves and our loved ones and each other from the spread of this invisible but deadly epidemic? That is a good reminder that it's really important to listen to science when especially the warnings are very, very clear.
As your survey found, people are worried about climate change for all the reasons that you have just been talking about it. Are Americans then interested and do they know what to do to address and mitigate some of the problems of climate change?
So here's where, again, it gets complicated because Americans are not a single mass. And in fact, in our work, we've identified what we call global warming six Americas, that there are six very different groups within the public that each respond differently. One group is a group we call the alarm. That's about a third of the country who are fully convinced it's happening, human caused, urgent. They're beginning to take some individual actions. But that question that you just asked is one of the big ones in their minds. What can I do as an individual? What can we do as a community, as a city, as a state, as a country, and as the world to really solve this? And then you have other groups that are at different levels of engagement. So the concerned think, yeah, it's happening in human cause, but they don't yet see it as urgent. The cautious are still on the fence. Is it real or not? The disengaged basically almost never hear about it. The doubtful think, it's just natural, so nothing we have to do with. And then last but not least is that 10% that we call the dismissive who are still stuck in this kind of conspiracy world. So the point is that Americans have very different responses to this issue, but most still don't yet really understand how we solve it.
Right, right. Does anybody?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, that's one of the most amazing things out there is that there is so much creativity. There's so much innovation. There's so much great stuff happening in the everything from the way that we produce and use energy. And in fact, we're seeing the spread of clean energy is the fastest growing sector of the economy. In fact, this is where it intersects with COVID. we need to do a massive economic reconstruction. And before the epidemic, the single fastest growing part of the economy was clean energy and energy efficiency. And those are jobs that can't be outsourced. Okay, I mean, China can't put the solar panels on your roof, right? So no, China can't come in and insulate your attic for you. Americans have to do that. So this is actually an amazing opportunity to put America back to work in building the future that we want to live in, as opposed to trying to go back to the dirty energy system of the past.
You're interested in climate change communication, and I would assume what you're saying is that the vastness of the problem can feel overwhelming, and if people just worry about it, worry sometimes doesn't lead to action, but that there are individual things that individuals can do to make a small but then maybe collective large difference.
Exactly. And so there are, it's like any big problem, is that you have to break it down into manageable pieces, or as the ancient Chinese saying goes, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. You have to take a single step, and then the next step, and the next, and the next. And once you get going, you're moving, and you're making enormous progress. So look, it ranges from everything from the individual behavior, like changing your light bulbs. That's the simplest thing to do. Insulating your attic. Please insulate your attic. You know, changing the way you eat and that you move around and so on. All good. But the fundamental changes are ultimately not the ones that we can do as individual consumers. It's about larger scale systems and structures. In other words, I would love to build myself my own private, high-speed, high-efficient bullet train from Philadelphia to L.A. I can't do that because I'm an individual. Elon Musk can't do that. We can only collectively, as Americans, decide that these are the kinds of structures that we want to put into place, changing the way that we produce our energy, changing the way we distribute that energy, changing our agricultural systems to become more resilient, et cetera, et cetera. That's ultimately decisions that get made by our government, okay? Government supposedly of, by, and for the people to make these collective decisions to achieve these things that we cannot achieve as individuals. That's ultimately where individual action, especially as it engages in demand that politicians act, is by far the most powerful thing that anyone can do.
We have about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye, and you mentioned this earlier. Do you then see climate change as playing a prominent role in the presidential election?
Well, my crystal ball is cloudy, as is so everyone's.
Right, exactly.
But it is, look, as of last November, climate change was the number one voting issue for liberal Democrats and number eight among moderate conservative Democrats. So I think Biden has every reason to talk about climate change because it's going to be crucial to him getting out and mobilizing his base. He's got lots of reasons or lots of ways to distinguish himself from President Trump. So he doesn't need climate change for that, but it is a way to mobilize his base. But we'll see what happens.
We sure will. Anthony Lajoie, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's director of the Yale Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. Well, speaking of doing individual things to help the climate, we'll be talking with Doug Tallamy. He's an entomologist. He says, think of your property as a national park. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest, Doug Tallamy, has a bold idea that he's named the Homegrown National Park. He's calling on everyone to reduce their lawns, often filled with non-native ornamentals, and replace them with native plants, shrubs, and trees. It would create an interconnected network of land to provide habitat for native birds and insects, including pollinators, whose numbers are in decline. While there are millions of acres of national and state parks where native plants and animals can find refuge, most of the land in this country is in private hands. Doug Tallamy writes in his new book, Nature's Best Hope, that we should look at our property, quote, as a small piece of a giant puzzle, which when assembled has the potential to form a beautiful ecological picture. It's easy to feel overwhelmed and helpless when faced with the threats of climate change and the loss of habitat and species. Talamy says one person can make a difference. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife at the University of Delaware. And Doug Talamy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Great to be back.
Nice to have you back. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, there's several ways you can do it. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Picking up on what our first guest was saying about the things that people can do, you say we are entering the age of ecological enlightenment. What are the signs and what are the implications of that?
Oh, boy. Well, I hope we're entering that age. The signs are that people are starting to get it, that we are actually part of nature. We're not separate from it. And as Rachel Carson said, any war against nature is a war against ourselves. Not too smart. They're also seeing, we're reading the headlines. The 3 billion birds disappearing, 1 million species scheduled for extinction in the next 20 years, according to the UN, insect global decline. This is scaring people. We have this sense that we really do need life around us, that dead zones aren't going to do it for us in the future. And so they're looking for change. What can we do? Fortunately, out of all the environmental issues we have, this is one the individual really can do something about and see the results immediately. If you own land, it's easy because you can manipulate the plants on that land. That's where all life starts. If you don't own land, you can volunteer in your nearest park or preserve because they desperately need you. But when you do those things, you will see the results. That's positive motivation, and you'll do it again. And then we see the change. So.
And let me pick up on all of that. But let me just also set the stage just to sort of put what you're suggesting into some kind of context and talk a bit about the national park system that we have. I think anyone that's been to a national park, especially out west, if you live in, the eastern part of the United States, the out west is just this extraordinary, beautiful, priceless national treasures. If you go to a Glacier or another of those parks there. But you say their parks have done their job, but they are limited because most of the land in this country is held in private hands.
Right. Our parks are to visit, but they are too small and too isolated from each other to actually preserve the amount of nature that we need. Nature is not just something spectacular we get to visit. It's something we need on a daily basis because it is the ecosystems that support us. We need functional ecosystems everywhere, not just in the pretty parts of the country. And the fact that they're so isolated now means that their role in protecting species and running those ecosystems is becoming more and more endangered itself. There's a steady drain of species from our national parks because of their isolation. So who's in between those parks? It's us. It's where we live, we work, we farm. We need to create functional ecosystems everywhere that humans exist. And that's a brand new concept, unfortunately. And we should have been doing that right from the start. But again, it's relatively easy. So that's the good news.
Well, and let me pick up, you mentioned the word endangered. So let me have you speak a bit about the Endangered Species Act, which you say has created some problems, that it has pitted property owners against conservationists, that it focuses on saving a single species rather than focusing on the ecosystem. Expand that for us, and then we'll talk about your big idea.
Right. Well, the Endangered Species Act was actually written by a lawyer hastily and overnight. And it was written with sticks rather than carrots. So if you had an endangered species on your property, you had to protect it or you got fined. And this, of course, has created an adversarial relationship with endangered species right away. There are people that will eliminate them from their property just so they have complete control. We need to be paying people to protect those species on our property. And that would change things immediately. All of a sudden, you get positive reinforcement. Everybody would be clamoring to have the red cockaded woodpecker on their property because they'd get a tax break or something. It's very easy to do this. And people say, well, how are you going to pay for that? Pay for it simply by the money you're not spending suing everybody. We waste enormous amounts of money trying to enact these things. That was the first part of your question. The second part...
I think you got it. Let's move on to your idea of this homegrown national park, the idea that I guess when we look at whatever little patch of land that we have, to think or perhaps rethink the role it can play in bringing back species.
Well, you know, I stumbled on this idea one day when I was just looking at the amount of acreage that is in lawn, which is essentially a dead zone. It's more than 40 million acres. Now, if we took half of that area out of lawn and turned it into a somewhat functional ecosystem, that'd be 20 million acres. And then I started looking, well, how big is 20 million acres? And I started adding up the area in our major national parks. It's bigger than all of them combined. If you add up all those parks, it's still less than 20 million acres. So I said, well, gee, we can create a new national park, and if we do it at home, we can call it Homegrown National Park. And it will provide those areas of connectiveness that are in between right now, dead zones, so that things can live outside of protected areas. They can live right where we humans are.
Help us understand, and can I say you're anti-lawn, or you certainly are a critic of lawns, the kind of trophy lawns that you describe you describe in your book? You're saying it takes 8 billion gallons of water daily to feed these 40 million acres of lawn. Obviously, a lot of people use pesticides as well. What's the problem with lawns?
I am a critic of too much lawn. You know, our landscaping has been designed for the last 100 years around aesthetics, and lawn is pretty, and so are our Asian ornamental plants. So it's all been what our landscapes look like. But in creating landscapes like that, we've essentially created dead zones. So now if your lawn has clover in it and a bee can visit it, you got to spray it with something and make sure it's just grass. So it's the amount of lawn. That's why I say cut it in half. Now, the lawn you keep, we want to manicure it. It's a cue for care. It shows you're still part of this culture, and you know you're not a renegade. You'll fit into your neighborhood, but you're going to have more plants in your yard, not acres of lawn, which you know nobody goes out there. The kids are not out playing on that lawn. It is just this barren, heated landscape that I guess it's pretty in some views, but. There's too much of the earth we're treating that way. We've got to put it back into function for our own good.
How would you compare its impact on things like paved streets and sidewalks?
Well, it's yes, it's better than pavement, but just a little bit. You get those summer thunderstorms with the downpours on the sunbaked lawn. Most of that water runs off immediately, just like it does on pavement. And what's worse than pavement is, you're right, we have spread fertilizer and pesticide. Homeowners use, I read a figure the other day from the Fish and Wildlife Service, 10 times the amount of pesticide that is used in agriculture. Where do you think that ends up? It runs off your yard into your watershed, polluting all of our aquatic system, creating dead zones in our Gulf and all the mouths of our major rivers. There's just nothing ecologically good about it. Also that it can look pretty. So let's look pretty, but have a smaller area that looks pretty.
What about, you mentioned clover, dandelions, weeds. I mean, you know, rather than having that perfect trophy lawn, just have it green but covered but filled with weeds.
Yeah, well, that's why I say manicure the lawn you keep. Okay, so it does fit our cultural norm of that perfect lawn. But you're going to put the blooming plants that are really helping our pollinators and everything else in the area that is not lawn at this point. So that's the trick. It's a new way of looking at your landscape. Notice I'm not talking about gardening.
No.
Because people view a garden as a little patch of your yard and the rest of everything else is lawn or something. I'm talking about the entire landscape. It's got to be functional. That includes the land owned by airports and the roadsides of 4 million miles of paved roads and power line rights of ways, all of this infrastructure that is millions and millions, it's 599 million acres, since if you want to add it up, that we do not think about in terms of conservation, but we could with just a little bit of modification of how we treat that land.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Doug Tallamy. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Doug, a couple of questions before I toss some more questions at you. One from Tom, who says, I live in a small suburb of Philadelphia, and the township insists on spraying for mosquito control. This reduces bee and butterfly population. Any suggestions or comments?
Yeah, it is a huge problem nationwide. Mosquito Joe. Everybody hires Mosquito Joe.
Yeah, I've seen those signs.
And, you know, when Zika virus made it to this Florida, and it actually never was replicated here, it was simply people bringing it in. That just caused an explosion in mosquito control. Mosquitoes are annoying. Most of the mosquitoes that are here are invasive species themselves, like Aedes aegypti and the Asian tiger mosquito. They're brought in. So I'm not saying we want to keep our mosquitoes. But spraying for adult mosquitoes is the worst way to try to control them. Mosquito Joe will tell you, well, it only kills mosquitoes. Not so. It kills all the insects that it contacts. You have to kill 90% of the adult mosquitoes in order to control the population. Studies have shown that these mosquito foggings only kill 10%. So it doesn't work. You want to attack your mosquitoes in the larval stage. And it ought to be standard fare that every home, every piece of property has what we call a mosquito dunk bucket. You get a bucket of water, you put in some straw or hay. That becomes an irresistible site for mosquitoes to lay their eggs. And then you put in a mosquito dunk. You get it at the hardware store. It's Bacillus thuringiensis. So it's a product that attacks only mosquitoes. It's species specific. Rather than spraying the world, which kills all the insects that we're trying to, I mean, global insect decline. It's insects that run the world, the little things that run the world. We cannot afford to be killing them all because we're annoyed with mosquitoes.
Let me pick up on that, because you quote E.O. Wilson, and one of the chapter about insects is called The Little Things That Run the World. Help us understand the role, then, that insects play in sort of keeping our planet going.
It's a crucially important role. There's several roles. First of all, if insects were to disappear, so would 90% of our flowering plants, which would essentially end energy flow through our ecosystems. Or change it so drastically that the food webs that support our animals, the amphibians, the birds, the reptiles, the mammals, would collapse, and they would all disappear. The rapid turnover of nutrients would end because our insect decomposers would be gone. And Wilson says, well, the earth would rot because you'd only have bacteria and fungi slowly turning things over. The kicker is humans would not survive any of those changes. So losing insects is not an option. We talk about needing pollinators. Well, you need them everywhere. Everywhere you want plants, not just in our parks and our preserves. That means you got to have pollinators at home. And that means you can't have everything in lawn, because lawn's not supporting any pollinators.
And when you talk about pollinators, I mean, I think we probably have a limited view of what a pollinator is. Expand that view for us.
We have 4,000 species of native bees. And we have one species of introduced honeybee, which is really good at pollinating a lot of our introduced crops. But before we brought the honeybee over, it was the 4,000 species of native bees. And then a number of other insects are fairly minor pollinators, doing the bulk of the pollination in North America. We also have 14,000 species of moths and butterflies. Now, they're not as good at pollinating, mm-hmm. although some have very specific relationships with plants, and plants totally depend on them. But there's so many of them, and they're out doing this, visiting flowers at night. You don't notice them, that they're very important components of our pollinator communities as well. But the trick with pollinators is many of them are specialists, so they can only reproduce using the pollen of particular plants. For example, around here, goldenrod, I think it supports 13 species of native bees. They can only reproduce on the pollen of goldenrod. If you don't have goldenrod, you just lost 13 species of bees. And then on and on down the list. So when you see a honeybee at your zinnia, which is a non-native plant, you say, well, I'm helping the pollinators. Well, you're helping a few generalist pollinators. But all of the specialist species that need particular plants, you're not helping at all. That's why we need
zinnias.
That. We need. Yeah,
I love
zinnias.
They're
pretty. Yeah. in addition to your zinnias, have a diversity of native plants that will be in bloom from April all the way to the end of October, because pollinators need pollen every day and nectar every day, not just once a week.
Here's a tweet from Coley who says, what would you suggest for people who are fighting non-native species like bamboo, which is so invasive? And, you know, your book in many ways is about the invasion that we've had of plants like bamboo and kudzu and others.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an invasion we created. We brought them over. We still sell them ornamentally. And, of course, they don't stay where we plant them. Bamboo is now outlawed in Dover, Delaware. It's just a terrible menace. And it doesn't deliver the food web services that the native plants do. That's the big thing about non-native plants. When they become invasive, they escape into our natural areas, and they displace those diverse native plant communities that are supporting the energy flow through our food webs. And people say, well, why don't, you know, the insects eat them? The insects can't eat them. And we're talking generalities here, because insects have to adapt to the defenses of the particular plants they specialize on. 90% of the insects that eat plants are host plant specialists. So, for example, monarchs. Everybody knows they need milkweeds. Well, if you take the milkweed away and put bamboo there, you don't have monarchs anymore. And that is true for 90% of the insects that eat plants. And that's what's happening with kudzu and all the other invasives that are out there. They're eliminating from particular areas the native plants that support the insects that then support our birds. We're not talking about just a few insects. A chickadee, for example, needs 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to make one clutch. It's a lot of insects we need out there. So your crepe myrtle, not making any. And that's the problem with using these ornamentals that don't support our food webs.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Doug Tallamy, and again, he's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. And he's got a new book we're talking about. It's called Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, our guest has a provocative idea. He says if Americans replanted about half of their lawns with native plants, shrubs, and trees, we would have more wildlife habitat than all the national parks combined. Again, he's a University of Delaware entomologist. His name is Doug Tallamy, and he's making his case for what he calls a homegrown national park to support declining bird and insect numbers. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Doug, we've been reading about something called, quote unquote, murder hornets. And then this is yet another thing that we have to be worried about. What and who are murder hornets, and should we be worried about them?
Murder hornets are giant Asian hornets. They're not murdering anybody.
Okay.
we've had, first of all, they're only in the state of Washington at this point. And they're social insects, so they form colonies. They're not large colonies. They do attack honeybee hives at the end of the season, and they wipe them out if the honeybees, they do wipe them out. So that's the potential problem, is that it's an issue for the honeybee industry. But I am predicting we will be able to eliminate. This is one invasive species that we can, they're easy to track down and easy to eliminate the colony. So I don't think we on the East Coast are ever going to have to deal with murder hornets. But this is an example. I call this media hype. Every time you hear about nature, it's always something bad. Something's going to kill us. Something's out to get us. They're, you know, the articles, they're terrifying. No, they're interesting. They're not terrifying, you know, and they're not going to come kill us. Our cell phones are going to kill us long before the murder hornets do, and we don't worry about that.
So. Well, that's good to know. I do want to talk about some of the things that are the plants, the trees that people should begin to think about. The oak tree being, I feel like, your favorite and perhaps a kind of a centerpiece in people's yards.
It is my favorite, and it's my favorite for good reasons. It does the most for us and for everything else in 84% of the counties in North America. So if you had to pick a single group of trees, a single genus of trees that is contributing the most, it would really have to be oaks. So what do I mean by that? Remember, we talked about all the insects we need, primarily caterpillars. They're right. The ones that are eating most of the energy from plants and passing it on to other animals. So you need landscapes with lots of caterpillars. And who's making those caterpillars? It's oaks. In this area where we live, 557 species of caterpillars on oaks. So you'll get your chickadee. It can reproduce and everything when you have those oaks around. So I call oaks and a few other trees keystone plants that when we're putting native plants into our yard, we need to use those keystone plants first. Keystone, remember in the Roman arch, it's the stone in the middle of the arch. If you take it out of the arch falls down. Well, if you take these keystone plants out of our ecosystems, the food webs collapse. So we want to start with them, and then we can build the diversity around them. But the old notion that, well, we're just going to put in any old native plant and everything will be great, we've just learned that's just incorrect. I could build an entirely native landscape. And if it didn't have any of those keystone plants, it would only have 25% of the food that we need. So it's an advance in our knowledge that we need to take advantage of and be sure we have those keystone plants in our landscapes.
Here's a related question from Michael, who says, can Doug Tallamy provide a list of native plants, shrubs, and trees that we can plant in the Delaware Valley to provide the support to native insects? And you talk about the oak tree as a kind of a keystone. What else?
Well, I can provide that list. Go to Native Plant Finder on the National Wildlife Federation website and plug in your zip code, and the ranked list of both woody plants and herbaceous plants for your county will pop up. And this is true for all over the country. So it's a very powerful tool that enables anybody to start using those important plants. Other important plants in this area would include our native cherries, so things like black cherry, our native willows, our birches. If we go to herbaceous plants, I talked about goldenrods. Perennial sunflowers are really important. Native asters are really important. Evening primrose, really important. But we're talking about literally thousands of plants, and the list is long. Mm-hmm. But I'm just talking about those very top ones that we could focus on.
You also talk about having water. That obviously birds like that, but even the sound of water is something that birds find attractive.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, the idea is that particularly migrating birds are spending their winter months down in the tropics where you have lots of streams and rivulets and they're always gurgling and bubbling little waterfalls. And when they come up here, they zero in on the same types of noises in order to get something to drink. I don't know if that's actually true or not, but it sure seems to work. When you make your little water feature have a little bubbling sound, they do come in. I talk about one family in Kirkwood, Missouri, Margie and Dan Terpstra, that made their bubbler. And they only have 6/10 of an acre, so it's not a giant piece of property. But they've recorded, I think it's 38 species of warblers, which is almost
wow.
all of them.
Wow.
In their yard, yeah.
Matt has an email. Does your guest know about what happened to the Cornell effort to map backyard habitats?
Yeah, that was Yard Map. I actually was on the board when that was being set up. It was, you know, it was funded by a national NSF grant to establish it, and the funding ended. It did go for a number of years after that, but I became disconnected. I'm not sure exactly what the final death blow was, but it was a good idea. It turned out to be a lot of work, and you had to be computer savvy. But it was supposed to be a way to socially connect people with like minds about putting biodiversity into their yard, and they could share ideas. And the concept was great, but it didn't take off at the level that we needed it to.
But it's not unrelated to what you're talking about, which is for everybody to look at their yard. If it's a tiny little, you know, little postage stamp versus something with long, sprawling lawns, but to think of that as a habitat and think about how that might connect to a neighbor's backyard, for instance.
Right. Remember, your little postage stamp is connected to another little postage stamp, which is connected to another one. So thinking in terms of entire neighborhoods as opposed to little teeny islands. But I don't want to discourage anybody. If your neighbor's not into this, and most people have neighbors who are not, do it anyway. Because, you know, I've been talking about this for, we're pushing 15 years now, and I do see a cultural change. The demand for native plants is skyrocketing. And we're going to get to the point where this becomes the accepted cultural norm for landscaping. And the guy with the giant lawn is going to become the social pariah. We already have seen this in the dry areas of the country where you can't have that big lawn unless you're wasting water. That's my prediction. It's going to happen. I see movement in that direction faster than I thought it would. Not there yet, but don't give up and be that little piece of the puzzle in your area.
Paul writes, he says, I'm a professional gardener, and I find that the majority of people are not up to doing the work to have a more natural garden. They may start for a season or two. Some stick with it. Most will not. Cutting grass, unfortunately, is much easier. What do you say?
Yeah, he's absolutely right. Most people don't garden, period. They hire somebody. We have this giant lawn industry that we hire, and this is a missing niche now. It's actually a career opportunity, and I call it ecological landscaping. The average homeowner, particularly young folks that are dealing with kids and soccer and everything else, they just want to hire somebody, and they ought to be able to hire an ecological landscaper, and with no questions asked, have what is needed done on your property. And that, you know, that, as I said, it's an empty niche. We need to fill it with knowledgeable people who will know what plants to put in, know how to make it attractive, and then take care of it. None of these landscapes are maintenance free.
Tell us, this is actually a funny part of your book. Tell us about your 10-step program, what that entails.
that's not really mine. A woman in New Orleans, Tammany Baumgarten, came up with that. She says, well, the 10-step program is you take 10 steps back from your tree and all of your insect problems disappear.
Right. And you don't see it, right?
What she means is, you know, little holes in our leaves. We tend to think of plants as if they're perfect apples. You know, you can't have one blemish or there's something wrong. The plants are there to capture the energy from the sun and then pass it on. If that energy doesn't pass on, you've got a dead landscape. So a leaf that hasn't been chewed a little bit is not contributing. Is it going to make it all terribly ugly? Well, no. Take those 10 steps back. You don't even notice those little holes. And that's what she's saying.
In your world, are weeds something we should fight against?
The definition of a weed is a plant out of place. Our native plants are not out of place. You know, crepe myrtle from China is out of place. Ailanthus is out of place. So when Europeans came over to this country, they started to farm in a way very different from the Native Americans that had essentially polycultures. We had monocultures, and any plant that grew up in those monocultures was labeled a weed. So that's how plants like Joe Pye weed and milkweed and New York ironweed, they all got the word weed, even though they're good native plants that are productive parts of our ecosystem, because they were growing where our crops needed to be and we had to get rid of them, so we thought. So let's rename some of these plants. How about milkweed can become Monarch's Delight? Then it's not a weed anymore and we don't have to kill it. I mean, because the word weed gives you culture permission to eliminate it, and, you know, big mistake.
Yeah. I have a couple of Japanese maples in my backyard. It was here when we bought the house. They're probably close to 100 years old. I don't really know. But do non-native plants sort of begin to acclimate over time, or maybe even do some of the functions of native plants when they've been here for, you know, tens of decades?
Yeah, that's a great question. Michael Pollan asked the same question. He says, when is there a statute of limitations on, right, on being non-native?
Yes, exactly.
Because, of course, we humans are non-native, too. We came over and colonized. The answer is a plant becomes a native when it acts like a native. And you can say, well, how do you know that? Go to where it is native and see what it's doing, what its ecological contributions are there. And when it matches those contributions here, then it has become a full-fledged native. Let me use the common reed, Phragmites, as an example. Right. It has been here 400 years. I'm going to choke here.
Don't choke.
Needed a drink.
Okay.
Excuse me. Well, in Europe, where it came from, it supports 170 species of insects. After 400 years here in the U.S., it supports five.
Wow.
So is adaptation happening? Yes, but it's really slow. It's going to be tens of thousands of years before that plant is as productive of as the plants it's eliminating when it moves into one of our marshes. So the answer is, yes, a non-native plant will become a native, but not in the ecological time frames that we're thinking of.
Let me read a couple of more comments from our listeners. Dave says, can the guest recommend a ground cover to substitute for lawn grass that is green in color and kids can still play on it?
Ooh.
Ooh. That's a tough
one. You know, grass is the perfect plant to walk on and play on without killing it. There are a few other things that can take that type of punishment. So here's excuse me.
Yeah.
Here's compromise. When you have kids and you're using it as a ball field or running around or dogs, that's a good time to have the lawn. But for example, my kids have been gone for over 20 years, and it's just, I don't need lawn like that anymore. I'm sorry.
Take
I'm,
that
I'm
another step.
No,
that's okay.
Yeah. So, you know,
you're
I
right?
opened the door and all the pollen's coming in here.
That's the downside, right?
I can't recommend a ground cover that you can abuse like that.
Right. I hear you. Let me just quickly reintroduce you so you can grab a little sip of water there. And again, talking with Doug Tallamy, and he's making a case for what he calls a homegrown national park. We are almost out of time here, but just a quick comment from Edward. This is something that you write about in your book. You say all the streetlights and house lights hinder wildlife at night and the growth of native trees, et cetera. Where do you stand on outdoor lighting?
Oh, boy. I just gave an assignment to my class to look at the impact of light pollution on insects. How does it contribute to global insect decline? They came back with some great research. It is far worse than I thought it was.
Really?
There are like eight ways that lights are killing insects, and that's just insects. So what it's doing to the phenology of plants around us. But it is just a major contributor to insect declines, particularly those moths. You know, when I say caterpillars, I'm talking about the larvae of moths, and it kills them every single night we have those lights on. So there are some easy fixes here. One is put a motion sensor on your security light so it only turns on when the bad man comes. And the first thing you'll notice is the bad man doesn't come very often. Second thing is use a yellow light, not a white light, because it's far less attractive to insects. And a yellow LED is least attractive. We could save billions of insects overnight if we simply changed our light bulbs.
Well, I always like to end on a positive note. Doug Tallamy, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And he's an entomologist at the University of Delaware. We've been talking about his new book, Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation that Starts in Your Yard. And he mentioned a website. We'll be sure to put that on our Facebook page so that you can check it out, having to do with native plants and trees that fit where you live. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.